LimarkTechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
That time.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for this Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for 40 years now, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, as always, like to give some useful links. If you would like to contact me and can't reach me over the radio, then email is a good idea. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. That would be for mailbag questions. That was in the old days when people couldn't contact Dick, K2RIW. He would send email, they would send email to him and he would answer it. Or if you have any topics that you'd like to hear discussed, or if you have any puzzles available. We really like technical puzzles that get our brains working and figure out things and remind us of things that we once knew. So all of those, plus if you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some NASA space-related thing, if you want to reach him directly, you can just use the email address spacenetreport@gmail.com, and that'll go directly to Paul, WS2N. Also, I want to remind you, we have a link. It has a lot of interesting articles that I've gleaned throughout the last week and some pretty pictures. Paul has a picture that he's going to cite on the SpaceNet report tonight. And the link page is roy.ac2gs.com. That's available 24/7 for the foreseeable future. We have a chat room available if you're so inclined. You can either go to Limark's own webpage and find the chat room link and click on it, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. We have an audio stream, so if you have any friends who are outside of a radio distance and would like to listen to the TechNet on audio, or Glen Oaks, the repeater, any time of the day, you can just tell them to type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you there. Also, I want to remind people, as usual, of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of the technical net is the site amateurradio.tv, with more than a million visitors, has archives of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006, with the wisdom of many amateur radio operators who've moved away from the area, and many have become silentees, unfortunately. So please avail yourself of that. Now let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okie doke, it's going to be a regular session here. I will ask people for any technical questions. I would prefer if the first few questions are amateur radio related questions, so keep that in mind. But as the night progresses, we'll open things up to any science or even medicine-related questions. We do not diagnose nor treat over the radio, but we can discuss things, and so keep that in mind. At about 10:15, hopefully, Paul, WS2N, will present us with this week's SpaceNet report. Should take us to about 11 p.m. I will return and put a bow on top and wish you all well and call it a week. So if the repeater and sundry other links in the chain will allow me to do that, that's my plan for tonight. So I will drop now and ask anyone for questions of a technical nature. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Jim, KG2RY.
Wayne, KG2UDU, supporting the net.
KG2RY with a question.
David and Wayne recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight?
KD2VHD, Jim.
Okay, Jim recognized. Once again, anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Roy, I had him go before me. He was number one.
No, The list is so far David and then Jim. So we're keeping the order right. I just wanted to know if there was anyone else who wanted to be put on the list.
Because I heard Jim, and then I went, and then I heard David. I guess the repeaters aren't synced up right.
Well, first, you missed David's first transmission. And because I was waiting a little bit longer, I guess he didn't know that I heard him. So it was actually David, then Wayne, then Jim, then David again.
I think we were doubling, Roy.
I don't think we were doubling. I heard you the first time. I didn't immediately acknowledge you, and you repeated it a second time. First you just gave me your name, and then I guess when Wayne said that he was just supporting the net, you wanted to point out that you had a question.
QSL, sounds good.
Doubled with David.
Okay, who said doubled with David?
Well, that's me, KD2UGU. Jim, I don't know what call sign, went before me. So he must have doubled with David.
Okay, I don't know. It's sort of a moot point. I don't expect for poor Jim to have to wait an hour and a half like last time. So we'll just go with the way that I hear it. I can't, what can I tell you guys?
Roy, we trust your judgment on this one.
Okay, so so David, I have you up first, so please, what's your question for tonight?
My question is, you have two radios, very similar in price and in ability and size, two different manufacturers, and they perform very differently from each other, you know? Maybe you can tell me some of the reasons for this, and specifically, you know, what could be going on inside the radios.
I'm not quite sure what the question is. Are you asking why two radios from about the same era with about the same specifications operate differently?
Well, they perform differently. You know, one of them has an extremely powerful modulated signal. The other one is more, how to say, like quality audio, but sacrificing the power.
Okay, well, you have to understand that especially, you know, legacy analog radios, which I would say about 95% of the radios that everyone has, very few people have software-defined radios. Even software-defined radios differ in their analog portion. There's more than one way to skin a cat, as the saying goes, and so even though the specifications are basically the same, there are nuances. There are low noise amplifiers and medium noise amplifiers that don't really factor into the specifications, dynamic range, linearity. Every manufacturer tends to buy slightly different modules for amplification and other functions. So even though they might, on paper, have roughly the same specifications, the nuances are probably different. The silicon's a little bit different. The circuit design is a little different. Some are a little bit more sensitive to internal noise, and some are better shielded against the noise. Some front ends have better specificity. Some have better sensitivity. And even beyond that, probably if you take the same exact model radio, there's a certain variation depending upon the settings that the company has in place to tweak and adjust the IF stages and the other factors. So there's a certain cluster of variation even in a given model. So there's a lot of room for variation, especially from different manufacturers.
USL, Roy. I tested these two radios. Same antenna, same tuner, different cables from the radio to the tuner. I found that in one case, it worked more stable when I connected a separate power source and I didn't use the power source in the cable. I found that whenever I connect the radios to a ground, they perform better and they're more stable. But to say, I connected another microphone to the radio, a different one, a replacement microphone from the same company, and it was about 5%, 10% more modulation, but not a tremendous amount. And to say every little step of the way, you know, try to get this radio to perform at least as well as the other one with a quality of receive audio is quite amazing.
Okay, I mean, like I said before, although legacy radios are kind of designed in the same way, there haven't been any really major changes in circuit design for analog radios in, say, 40 years since the balanced modulators of the 50s for single sideband, maybe phase lock looping from the 70s. So, you know, for the last 30, 40 years, kind of the same thing, although different manufacturers have slightly different specifications. Even when it comes to something as simple as a microphone, I think one of the things you get when you buy a relatively expensive microphone is a degree of consistency. There's much better quality assurance and consistent behavior. I've seen more than enough YouTube where people will buy a batch of 24 cheap microphone elements from China and go through the 24, come up with about 3 or 4 mic elements that sound great to them and to other people. And, you know, when you factor in the cost, it's cheaper to do that if you want to actually go hunting for a good element, as opposed to other companies, other countries that charge you much higher. They do the testing and they winnow out the bad driver elements of microphones. So it's not uncommon, as from my experiences, I'm sure from the other people listening in, that they, different radios that should kind of sound similar seem to have different qualities. Some people like the audio quality of one brand over another. Sometimes that's an actual obvious extension of the fact that some companies invest in a lot of audio modules of the same design and just plug them into different models for the next few years until they run out of stock. So, but other times you never quite know. So it's always good to kind of test out the model if you have a friend or you know, someone who will let you play with their radio. I know other people who unfortunately decide to just buy different radios and trade them in every month or two. And so they have a good broad spectrum understanding of the different quality. But that's the nature of radios. They're not one size fits all. If you spend enough time and if you take the trouble to listen closely, you'll discern differences with different models and even some variation within a model.
Yeah, but this radio, I opened it up and I carefully pushed in the ribbon connector. You know, there was like 10 or 12 ribbon connectors inside this radio. I think it's a kind of like a way of doing it cheaply, but ribbon connectors, you know, can come loose. This radio was in transit, and there wasn't enough packing material that's packaged by UPS. So the radio was bouncing around in there. And I pushed one of the ribbon connectors in and slight click, and then I turned on the radio, and I realized that some of the features that were missing were working, you know, and say, what's going on here, and how do I get this thing to work like the other one? And I guess, like you say, you realize that there are differences in all of them, and, you know, you have to accept the differences or, you know, buy a radio every 2 years.
Well, yeah, and ribbon connectors are legitimate ways to connect separate boards. You can't always populate a single board with all the electronics in the given space that you've decided is what you want your radio to form fit to. So you have to then deal with multiple circuit boards, and you have to somehow connect them together. Theoretically, I guess you could just have pins that are attached to the different circuit boards and just shove the pins in. Other times, it allows for more flexibility for the electrical engineers designing the circuits where the pins don't have to line up to use those ribbon cables. And you know, a lot of times they don't have a problem. I had also a problem with a ribbon cable. I had a TYT, I think it's a 3800. It's a nice little, relatively inexpensive DMR UHF handy talkie. The ribbon cable that feeds the display sometimes gets loose. So you have to open it up and reinsert it, unfortunately. You know, I think that's, again, a quality assurance issue. If you design these things better, they tend not to come loose quite as easily.
Comment.
Yes, Ed.
K2CJE. Different companies have different engineers that have different approaches. Also, sometimes they are restricted in their design by patent. A company that I worked for many years ago, they had more patent attorneys than electrical engineers, and any time the electrical engineers came across something that was slightly patentable, they would patent it, and that meant then for other companies to use that, they had to pay royalties. So designs may vary, and a loose ribbon doesn't say it's a bad radio. Evidently, it became better when you pushed the connector in. So there's a lot of variables involved. You had the fortunate to have two on the bench, and if you didn't like one, well, that's the one you sell. Over.
Okay, very good, Ed. Yeah, there's a lot of things that go in, and you know, we as amateur radio operators, we're kind of just consumers. We don't design any of these things. And so there's intellectual property, as you mentioned. There's price point. They want to keep the price down. So if you could get by using a less expensive circuit design, they'll go with that. And sometimes it's as absurd as that they bought way too many audio modules that they have to get rid of. They have more than enough to fulfill the previous model, and they have surplus. So, you know, they'll push the engineers to reuse the same audio circuit. I think to a degree that was one of the problems with ICOM. ICOM's microphone preamp was always kind of weak. I don't know how much of that is just a philosophy on ICOM's part at the time, or that they just bought a lot of preamp mic modules, and they couldn't throw them away, so they kept on putting them in their transceivers.
Well, yeah, that was part of the problem with this radio. The modulation was weak. I'm not sure if I completely fixed the problem. So what I can see for power output on the tuner meter, for one radio it's 100%, and on this radio it's like 70%.
Well, have you used a third-party watt meter? Because, you know, not all watt meters in radios are as accurate as others.
Well, the tuner is an external meter, but I might go for an inexpensive watt meter and see what's coming, you know, out of the radio.
Yeah, different radios have different gain values. You could turn a knob to mid-position, and it'll offer you a different amount of gain. Again, it depends upon the microphone itself. If it's not the same microphone, sometimes you can do A/B tests, but sometimes you depending upon the connectors, sometimes you can't.
Well, I'm using a microphone that replaces the old one. The improvement was about 5 or 10%. Not so much. I might need to get some kind of preamp to put in there.
Okay, if you don't think you're driving it hard enough, that's always an option. There are numerous ways of accomplishing it. They sell microphone preamps on Amazon, and there's a lot of other companies, retailers that sell all kinds. Get something that's obviously wide-ranging variable and play around with it. You never know what you'll find out.
QSL, well, even microphones have preamps built into them. You can get microphones that have preamps built into them. You know, you put a battery in there and you turn the volume up.
Yes, if you buy one built like that. But most, in my experience, unless you really consider electrolytes most dynamic microphones I'm aware of usually don't have their own built-in preamp amplification circuits. So they usually depend upon the radio's amplifier preamp.
Well, my old ham radio from the 70s, I had a microphone. It was taken from a CB radio, which had the same connector as the ham radio. And all I did was plug it in, battery was in, and, you know, signal was out.
Enough already.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of D104s from the good old days, and they used to have a piezoelectric element. And you put a 9-volt battery in, and then although some people thought it was an impedance matching circuit, it was probably just as much a microphone preamp circuit.
QSL, I call ICOM tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay, very good, David. So was that the question for tonight?
Well, you know, I see how the other radio performs, you know, what it can do. This one, you know, not enough modulation for signal so that, you know, the peak, when you're talking, you know, through the radio into the tuner meter, you see the meter peaks the other radio 100%, and on this radio about 70% with a very light signal, you know, I think that explains a little bit of something. I think the problem is with the modulation, and I'm going to ask a few questions to the tech people at ICOM and see what they say.
Okay, very good. Yeah, you have to realize single sideband is kind of a variation on amplitude modulation, but you have to, the microphone gain to the circuit really impacts upon the maximum output envelope of the single sideband signal. So unless you don't want to run it into the distortion, into the nonlinear range, but is keeping it as high as you can in the linear range will get you a little bit more peak output power. This is why a lot of times people will trigger compressors, compander and expander type circuits to kind of squeeze as much RF out of their audio signal.
Yeah, but you know, with this microphone that I've tested, you know, ALC all the way to 50%, so it goes to middle of the meter, which is where it's supposed to be, without going beyond. So that is okay. Seemingly, there's enough modulation there, but the modulation, the signal, it doesn't reflect the modulation to the tuner meter, you know, about 70%.
Okay, so it's a good idea. Call up the company, have a little chat, consider a microphone preamp circuit. Like I said, they come in all kinds of shapes and sizes and power utilization. And if you come up with something good, certainly come back and share it with the rest of us here.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Dr. Roy. Have a good night.
You're welcome, David, and thank you for participating. Jim, KD2VHD, what's your question tonight?
Good evening, Doc. As I wend my way through the menus of these radios I've been playing with to learn this hobby, I'm bumping into something called two-tone signaling and five-tone signaling. I have an imagination of what that might be, but I was wondering if somebody could explain it and technically. And secondarily, is it possible to use something like that to open up the squelch on an otherwise quiet radio using that? And the second and a half part of the question is, would using that on occasion on a repeater such as this be considered out of form? I think that's the whole of the question. Over.
Okay. Usually two-tone testing, two-tone testing is a tone and a second tone that's not a harmonic of the first tone. And it's usually used to detect things like intermod distortion and such. So usually you need some kind of test equipment along with it to make any sense of what you're getting out of it. It's primarily for intermod distortion measurements. And I assume you don't have any equipment to measure that. So it's an interesting thing to have. And, you know, if you ever get an oscilloscope and some test equipment, you might want to check out things like that. But I think it's a little esoteric. Most regular amateur radio operators who have maybe a voltometer and maybe, on a good day, a nano VNA, I don't think they really use the two-tone testing or the five-tone testing mode at all.
Okay, thank you for the response. Have a good evening. KD2VHD on the side, listening.
Okay, very good, Jim. I mean, if anyone else has any opinions, and I would assume that they do some calibration equipment and such. You know, if they have anything to say about two-tone testing, feel free. Okay, nothing much. By the way, I want to thank the repeater committee in general for having the repeater functioning. We got EchoLink tonight. We have IRLP tonight. We have a nice link between the two repeaters. And miracle of miracle, we have a simple single tone when we unkey, as opposed to that melodious thing that we had for many years that more than one person told me they got migraines from listening to. So I want to thank them for that single tone. It's going to take me at least a week or two to get completely used to it, but I'm looking forward to that. Gotta love that single beat. Anyway, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limar Technical Net. We're here to discuss, hopefully, technical questions, problems, both amateur radio and general science and even medicine. So if anyone out there has any questions of a technical nature, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Alpha Bravo 6, Mike Bravo.
Yes, Jeff. Jeff, AB6MB, is the net control operator for the Papa Network Antenna Net. Great net. Friday night on the Papa Network, you can get through it through Echolink and sundry D-Star gateways. Yes, Jeff.
Thank you, Roy. Yeah, we had a talk on last Friday night on VNAs and SWR, you know, testing devices. And, you know, I kind of wondered if the VNA can take the place of the expensive, you know, handheld SWR testing. You know, the usual from the different companies have those really nice handheld ones for checking your antenna and that. I just kind of wonder, what is the VNA's place versus the SWR meter one? Go ahead.
Okay, well, it sort of depends. I mean, the standard watt meter / SWR device is good if you want to directly test the standing wave ratio with your transmitter transmitting a given amount of power. So in other words, if you want to know exactly what your VISWA on your antenna system is when you're throwing a kilowatt, having a watt meter / SWR meter is better for that purpose. If you simply just want to know what the standing wave ratio for a given antenna system is, absent your transmission power, VNAs which supply their own power, you can't type your transmitter power through a VNA, serves the purpose with a lot more whistles and buzzers. Whereas a standing wave ratio watt meter just tells you the ratio, you know, if you're 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 or 4-to-1, a VNA will give you the impedance. It'll tell you if it's inductive, it'll tell you if it's capacitive, and if you sweep it across a frequency range, will give you a better perspective for how the antenna operates through a wider range of frequencies than the watt meter SWR, which requires you to actually move your own transmitter's sweep frequency and write down the numbers. The my Flex 6700 actually had some guy who automated that process. You would run his program, he would take the Flex 6700 and sweep it across frequencies, record the SWR values at those points, and then plot it for people. But most radios don't kind of come with that nice feature.
Yeah, I apologize. I didn't phrase the question correctly. I meant an antenna analyzer, handheld antenna analyzers that you can buy. Everybody has one. You know, they're very handy for, you know, for you know, testing your antenna, exactly what you described. The VNAs are coming out like $75, and the other rig experts are like up in the hundreds of dollars. I kind of wonder if the VNAs are going to replace those other meters. So I just kind of want to get an idea, you know, what a VNA versus antenna analyzers, you know, do you just get one of each, or... You know, I just kind of wonder about it. We had a discussion about that on the net the other night. Go ahead, Roy.
I misunderstood. A lot of times there's a very fuzzy aspect to what an antenna analyzer is. A lot of times guys will call a VNA an antenna analyzer because in the very beginnings of places like MFJ, rather than a full-fledged vector network analyzer, they primarily were selling adjustable SW impedance bridges. So in other words, it would kind of tell you what your impedance was in relation to a 50-ohm nominal of value. I think those things are going to be a relic of the past. When you can buy something much more informative for $65, it makes no sense to buy an MFJ antenna analyzer that isn't really a VNA that was going for about $200-$300. It still might have made sense if your other choice was the more expensive commercial products that were $500-$600, but the price of VNAs have plummeted. I'm sure there's going to be other companies that are going to go into it as well. Rig Expert is offering a bunch of less expensive versions of the VNA, so I think MFJ is going to be kind of stuck with their stock. I don't see a old-time antenna analyzer device persisting. You know, if you own it, you own it, and you can use it, and it works. But most people, I don't think they're going to find a place for it. I certainly wouldn't have both of them actively operating, because one is more, it's kind of redundant information. The antenna analyzer from MFJ will only give you a sense of the impedance. It won't give you, as I mentioned before, just generally with watt meters, won't give you whether it's inductive or capacitive, and a bunch of other nice features that proper VNAs have. So I think the old style MFJ antenna analyzers are a thing of the past for the most part.
Okay, Roy, thank you very much. Yeah, I want to get your take on that. That's what I was kind of thinking. One thing that was brought up was that the VNAs ergonomically are awfully small and awfully fragile. You know, and I just think that that's one of the drawbacks of them, you know, if they're going out in the field. But I think that I'll have to go on Rig Expert and see what they have. And, you know, they probably make it more rugged and maybe with bigger screens. You know, screen was mentioned. And then the, the ruggedness of it. You can drop one of those VNAs and break them pretty easily. Back to you, AB600B.
Yeah, I would agree. You got to be a little bit gentle with them. They're really not designed for a lot of outside work, where you drop it and such. But the Rig Expert line, depending upon the oscillator, the range that you want to operate in, have become very cost effective. They are incredibly rugged. They have a very good user interface. I own a AA600. It's a great thing to have. They're improving the design. They have a series of slightly smaller, lighter weight VNAs. They have a zoom series that gives you a color image that's prettier than most that I've seen before. So, it depends on it. But, again, the MFJ antenna analyzer, it was a metal box, and it had a meter on it and a dial. The user interface on something like a Rig Expert is much, 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 much better. And it's nice, tough plastic. It's not metal, but it's a very rugged design. The Nano VNA is a great little in-shack type of device. I wouldn't knock it around outside too much. It's not really designed for that. But it's an indication that, it doesn't cost that much more to build up the structure of the case and such. And so I would still go with, if you're going to do it on the outside and you want something that hangs from your belt, Rig Experts are good company. They've been around for a while now. They've been very helpful when I needed help from them. So, and there will be other companies that probably market similar, sturdier built versions of the Nano VNA.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, Roy, thank you very much for your take there. I was really interested in hearing what you have to say. Maybe others have a comment on it. So back to that, KB670.
Okay, very good, Jeff. Thank you for participating tonight. Anyone else with any opinions about the VNAs versus the old MFJ antenna analyzer design?
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I think the Nano VNA,
As far as doing antenna analysis, that's going to give you S11, which is just the reflection coefficient, if I'm not mistaken, and you a little conversion, and you can get that into SWR.
Yeah, I think there are multiple graphic displays that, you could use to, get the information that you want.
Yeah, I think it does have the conversion to SWR, if I'm not mistaken. I know I have one. I haven't really played with it that much, but I know it does show a direct reading for S11 and S21. In terms of scattering parameters, but I think you can convert to SWR.
Yeah, I would agree. I haven't played with it lately, unfortunately, haven't had the time, but it has multiple display capability screens, and there's a computer interface program that's for free. You plug it into the USB connector of your computer, and you can run it there, or you could run it on the little teeny LCD screen. I bought the one that's 4-inch diagonal, as opposed to, I think, the smaller one is something like 2.5-inch, which is a little too small for me. Some people have better vision than others. For those people who say that, you know, they can't spend a couple of $100 for a VNA, I think this is a reasonable alternative for them. If people really use it a lot and use it outdoors a lot, then, you know, something a little bit more rugged is probably a better fit. But you have to pay for rugged.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. One thing I want to do when I start to play with it, I want to do some comparison with the full-fledged VNA, just to see how the nano VNA, racks up against it. So it's one of the things I have planned one of these days.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds interesting, and I would love to hear your results. My sense is that its dynamic range is not as good as the more expensive ones are. So for people who want to use something like this to tune up a duplexer for a repeater, it might not be that easy to do using this. Last week or the week before, we got into a discussion that the signal generator portion is a square wave generator, as are most of the, I think, under $1,000 or $2,000 VNAs. And that could interact with some circuit designs. It really doesn't impact on antenna measurements, as far as I'm aware. But there was a YouTube of a guy building amplifier circuits, and the square wave was interacting and giving specious results on his nano VNA.
Yeah, I heard you mention that last week. I don't know, that sort of sets off a little warning bell in my head. Maybe I'm wrong, but if the signal source is a square wave and this is a vector network analyzer where a phase is critical measurement, wouldn't there be a problem with a square wave having harmonics and possibly one of those harmonics upsetting the phase information? Because if it's supposed to be a vector network analyzer, that means it's measuring magnitude and phase. It just doesn't seem quite copacetic that they would use a square wave signal source for that. But I could be wrong. It just doesn't sit right with AI.
Fantasia.
Wesley recognized. Well, I just want to point out that even the rig experts, I think I basically, I have two other VNAs, both roughly about $400 or $500, and as far as I'm aware, I think I looked specifically into rig experts. Their technical information is that they too use a sweep generator that's a square wave. Wesley, what would you like to say?
Professional network analyzer gives you magnitude and phase on the sinusoidal wave in every bit of it, or let's say every point on the sinusoid. If you're dealing with a square wave, that depends on the duty cycle of that square wave. And when it's flat on the top, practically you are stripped from ability to see the phase. You see only the magnitude. That's why it's not that accurate. As far as the harmonics are usually all the higher magnitude, although they are components of the square wave. So I don't believe that harmonics would probably cause error in reading, but definitely phase is going to suffer on it. Interesting.
Okay, but apparently not enough to impact upon your standing wave ratio and impedance sweep. Because again, a rig expert uses square wave, and a bunch of other companies use square wave sweeping generators.
Comment.
Okay. First, you have front of the wave, and you have a back of the wave. So it's leading edge, vertical. Let's say. With that, you can measure nothing. Zero, zippo. You can measure only the magnitude. You can see the phase difference at the point when the negative part of this square wave is changing from zero up to the positive one. That's all the information that you have. So I have a problem with the thing.
DDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Well, let's take an example. I mean, let's say you have a load, it's 50 plus J100 at 10 megahertz, and you're sweeping it with a 10 megahertz square wave. If it's a 50% duty cycle, a square wave, a square wave, then it's got 10 megahertz in the third harmonic in it at 30 megahertz. So if you're hitting it with 10 megahertz, it's going to be 50 plus J100. If you're hitting it with 30 megahertz, it's going to be 50 plus J300 because the inductive reactor says you triple the frequency, goes up three times. So it seems you're going to get more reflection from the component of that square wave at 30 megahertz than you would from the fundamental of the square wave at 10 megahertz. And it just seems that that would throw the phase measurement off. If you were trying to make, say, an S11 measurement of that kind of load. Go ahead.
Okay. I wish I had an answer. I never really investigated how VNAs, how inexpensive VNAs do their magic. I assume that to the degree that amateur radios require it, they suffice. I would assume that if it was that much distortion that couldn't be somehow self-corrected, they wouldn't be terribly useful devices. People wouldn't be buying them and using them with great regularity.
This is one of the things I have to play around with before I get back to working in the real world again. During my break, I do want to play around with this nano VNA. I do have one, as I said, it's sitting there over there on the shelf. I just haven't had a chance to play with it. So I'm going to see what happens when I take some some reactive loads and put it on there and just see how it affects when I measure S11. Anyway, okay. I'll let you get on to the next comment, Roy.
Interesting.
Okay, very good, John. Yes, Wesley, you want to make a comment?
You have a square wave, and then there is a mismatch of impedance, and the square wave is returning back. Then the square wave depends from the mismatch, is not returning back, covering back the same
position on the square wave, but it's taking, let's say, half or one third. It looks like when you look at the foregoing and reflected, you see like two square waves. In the cheap VNAs, like in every VNA, you have a generator that is sweeping frequency from the lowest to the highest on the given bandwidth. And then your circuitry, your receiver, is actually scanning for the presence of the magnets and the phase. Now, if you have just a square, then it goes rapidly from the highest to zero, and through the zero goes down to the highest and the negative part of the square wave. Now, if you have a returning one, the cheap one, the VNA has a problem with recognition, how to read the reflected one, which is partially mismatched in position with the foregoing one. And that's why all of the problem happened. So, regular VNA doesn't use the square wave. And that's where most of the problem is. And to actually...
Okay, but when you say most VNAs don't use a square wave, most VNAs that amateur radio operators use, because we're cheap guys, and we don't want to spend $5,000 for a VNA. So some of us buy $65 nano VNAs, some others buy $500 rig experts, but they all sweep with a square wave.
Well, Dr. Vo, you're going to a cheap restaurant and you're eating junk food, and then you still feel like fool. It's okay. Question is, what are the consequences to your body? So that would be, that if you use the cheap tool, you expect the cheap results. If you're happy with that, then it's okay.
Well, you know, salesmen, as a rule, never use the word cheap. Pharmaceutical salespeople regularly disparage me when they were trying to tell me that their medication is less expensive, and I would respond that, oh, it's cheaper. So I don't know what to make of that. I think that a compromised, radically inexpensive test equipment, which amateur radio operators could get great benefit from, is better than a theoretical laboratory calibration equipment that no one in their right mind will buy new. And occasionally, smart people can buy it very used and less expensive. So I don't like it disparaging nano VNAs and other VNAs in that they cut corners. For the purposes that most of us are going to use them for, those corners don't impact upon us, at least not me, maybe you. So I think that the average guy who sometimes, occasionally, rarely, comes on and says, gee, what the hell is the matter with my antenna? The easiest way to answer is plug it into something like a nano VNA, sweep the frequencies, and take a look what the curve looks like. Just because it's not calibrated to the national standards doesn't mean it's not a legitimately useful tool, especially for us.
VDH with a comment?
I must absolutely agree with you. You're absolutely right. Good point. You buy $200, $300, $500, $900. You're absolutely good for the money. There are plenty of old stuff that you can buy right now, the 4140 is absolutely, the tool is 35 years old now, but it's absolutely better for impedance measurement, gain and phase measurement. Great tool. You can get it for $900, $1200. The only inconvenience that you have is that it's a big box instead of something that you have a portable. So if you feel like you want to use portable, that's fine. That's fine. That's good with me. You're satisfied with what you have because you didn't see what the other thing can do. People can go to Harbor Freight and buy cheap screw gun three times, and there's no screw gun. Okay, so it's okay. Whatever somebody likes and feels comfortable with, it's okay with me. And to XGM.
Okay. John, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, as I think about it, you know what they might do in there? In the receiving section, when you're taking an S11 measurement, which is the reflection coefficient, you're sending signal out, and then you're getting the reflected component back. And then the ratio of the of the reflected to the outgoing is giving you the reflection coefficient, which is what they call S11. They might, in the receiving section of that DNA, they might have the ability to reject any of the higher harmonics of the square wave. So even though they are sweeping with a square wave, they're only looking at the fundamental component coming back. They might do something like that, and that would avoid any of the distortion component or the higher harmonic components of the square wave. But I'm going to be investigating that to see really what's going on there.
Okay, very good, John. And again, I'd love to hear your report when you suss it out. I should read up on how these things work. I once had a long treatise on the nano VNA, and I don't know, it was just too many pages at the time. So I put it on my list of things to read sometime in the future. But getting back to Wes, I don't quite know if I would quite term the nano VNA harbor freight. I mean, it's very inexpensive. So it comes precariously close maybe to that. But, you know, when you're talking about something like a rig expert for $500-$600, I wouldn't call that a cheap purchase. And again, it sort of depends what you're planning to do. If you're an electrical engineer and you're going to require the best equipment, then okay, so be it. Amateur radio operators just want to know what impedance their antenna systems are. And for that, you don't need too many bells and whistles. So, again, it's not like I make any money off of these companies that sell these things. I just think it's a wonderful opportunity for people who do not have that much money to spend on laboratory equipment but are deeply interested in why their antenna might not work. That's not to say that the only thing that you have to worry about for antenna design is impedance matching. Impedance matching is important, and having a resonant antenna is very important, but there are other factors such as efficiency and takeoff angle and all kinds of fun stuff to consider in addition to impedance matching. And you know, I think it's a good investment for the average guy. Again, if you just got your degree in electrical engineering and you're starting some kind of a design lab, maybe you should spend some money on maybe a Rohde & Schwarz if you don't need it. But I don't think I need Rohde & Schwarz. And I agree with you, Wesley, that if you are a smart shopper, you can buy a big, heavy, old thing that does better. But for me, personally, space and weight is a major factor. Something that I could put away in the side of a little drawer is a lot better than something I gotta hang on a shelf someplace or leave on the floor and stub my toe against every so often. So, you know, whatever suits you.
Yeah, interesting. You have a fundamental fifth harmonic, and you put them together, you're getting your square wave signal. And the more harmonic you get, the better is your square wave. There is a certain relationship between time domain and frequency domain. So you have a Fourier theory, then you have repetitive signal that is compressed as a summation of single frequency signals. And they tear the square wave. For example, it's an infinite summation of harmonics of sine wave with the same frequency as the square wave. So by that, we might say that if we go to TDR and TDR function on VNA, which is one of the functions of VNA is a frequency domain device. The inverse Fourier transform can be used to convert frequency domain to time domain. To do this, there has to be a harmonic relation between the frequencies in frequency domain. A harmonic